And that song was Born in the Wrong Time by The Great Unwashed, the group that formed after The Clean by the Kilgour Brothers and the late Peter Gutteridge, who wrote that tune. Now, I was a teenager when that came out in the 1980s, and I certainly felt like I was born in the right time back then, along with the rest of Generation X. And 30 years have now gone by since American writer Douglas Copeland wrote what turned out to be a signature novel of that time, Generation X, Tales for an Accelerated Culture. And looking back on his own book recently, Douglas Copeland said he wrote it partly because he hated being classified as a baby boomer, and he hoped that labels like that, man, Generation X, Y and Z and so on, will soon fade away. And in his corner on that is Bobby Duffy. He's the director of the Policy Institute at King's College London and the author of a new book, Generations, How and Why We Change.
With baby boomers, the discussion around baby boomers, obviously we've got names for generations that come before that, but really it was that baby boomer discussion as the generation of the 60s, and then moving into my generation, Generation X, and then really took off when we started to talk about millennials and now Gen Z or Gen Z. So it's a relatively recent focus on this kind of labeling, summing people up or summing whole cohorts up in just a few characteristics. That's relatively new.
And indeed, 30 years since Douglas Copeland's book, Generation X, and he himself recently, writing for The Guardian, declared himself a bit fed up with the way these generations will be labelled. I think he said this business of labelling and trashing generations is eternal. But at first I was thinking, did he even coin the term? But I thought it was unlikely. And then I was reminded there was Billy Idol's punk band beginning in about late 70s, mid-70s. But Douglas Copeland himself apparently says he took it from a book called Class by Paul Fussell.
That's right.
Yeah, who's an interesting guy himself, right? Because he was part of that wartime, the greatest generation, if we're into labelling people, and who, having gone through the war, then turned his mind to, well, what is it about the experiences of generations that differentiate themselves from others?
Yeah, that's exactly. And some really big thinkers have thought about generations. The kind of godfather of how we think about generations now is probably Karl Mannheim, who was a Hungarian sociologist who wrote mostly at the turn of the 20th century, because what was core to the thinking of generations is that what's happening when you're young, going through your formative years in late teens and early adulthood, is crucial to shaping your attitudes, beliefs, behaviours, worldview overall. And obviously the First World War was hugely traumatic experience for younger generations who were effectively sacrificed by older generations in that war. That's the focus of lots of thinkers around that time, and it's kind of informed our thinking now. It's not just about those big traumatic events that shape generations. There is this constant grind of culture change that pushes generations apart, makes them different from each other. And I guess one of the key points of the book is we shouldn't be frightened of that. Younger generations come in with new ideas or new perspectives. In fact, if we didn't have that, we would go stagnant as societies because we tend to get stuck in our ways as we get older. So while it may feel uncomfortable that there's differences between generations, actually it's essential for the progress of society. So we shouldn't be too focused on this conflict is bad or this sense of tension is bad between the generations.
Well, Douglas Copeland said there's a false assumption of human sameness. He said that's the key ingredient of this generational discussion. But he said because without it, you can't demonize younger people. And he says there's a ton of money to be made from demonizing the young. And we'll come back to that because it's a key part of your book and a fascinating part. But he does say this kind of generational trashing is eternal human behavior. But it's because we all just never collectively live long enough to see this repeatedly deployed and realize that it's silly.
It's interesting. I'm not sure I agree with the point about this is repeated throughout history. Absolutely. So you can go back to Socrates in 400 BC, and he said that the young people in his time, the generation coming through then, were the worst generation ever. No manners, no respect, only a love of luxury. A big long diatribe. He really didn't like young people in his day, but that's repeated throughout history, that where it's always the latest generation of young people that are uniquely wrong or weird. It's not so much that we don't live long enough. I think it's more these biases that we have, where we've got this sense of rosy retrospection about our own lives. It's a kind of well-known social psychology bias where you sort of forget the bad bits from your life in the past. And so we've got this too rosy view of how we were. And it makes us think that the things that are happening today are uniquely different or bad. It's how societies change and evolve. It would be more worrying in some ways if we thought young people today were great or the same as us, because that would really signify that we've stopped that sense of progress or change.
Well, one of the more touching things in your book was, if you forgive me for saying it, but before I even got into the book proper, it's the sort of dedication in the front. You say, for Jimmy, Birdie, Bobby, Mary, Jim, Anne, Jim, Louise, Bridget and Martha, four generations of my family who will see 200 years of history between them. And that's a reminder, isn't it, that this generation thing, whether we're setting those false benchmarks, as you just talked about, from Rosalie picking out the best of the bit we lived through and making others live up to it. I mean, we all overlap, don't we? And we should know that it's not a matter of one generation ending and another very different generation taking over, and history doesn't work in straight lines.
Yeah, no, it's such a good point. It is. Our connections up and down the generations through our families are stronger than our connections across to our peers within our cohorts. In many ways, we deeply care about our grandparents and parents, and looking after them as they get older, and we deeply care about the future that our kids and grandkids will inherit. And that's why things like the myths that you see around generations about older people just not caring about climate change, even when Greta Thunberg was made Times Person of the Year in 2019, they called her an avatar in a generational battle. And that's the wrong framing, I would argue. When you look at the evidence on what is the actual gaps between young and old on concern about the climate or wanting to do something about the climate, they're not nearly as large as you think, as is made out in lots of the discussions. And that's because of that connection, that really strong sense that older people have of looking after the next generation, whether it's our own family or just the sense of legacy of what we leave behind. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind, with the conflict and the difference is exaggerated. And really, we're much more interconnected than that impression that you get from that kind of more simplistic coverage.
Yeah, I mean, if you were asked people to name celebrity climate campaigners, a lot would probably say Greta Thunberg, but then probably in second place would be Sir David Attenborough, aged 90-something right now, and maybe in the middle, Al Gore, who's a few years back from that, I'm guessing. So, yeah, it is a multi-generational thing. I wonder, are we conditioned to this a bit, though, this history in straight lines? Because thinking anyone who had a bit of a traditional education, these eras of monarchs, if it's British history, Edwardian, Elizabethan, Victorian, this is literally the lifespan of these reigning rulers. And in the book you talk about, I think you label it the power of the life cycle. All of our succeeding monarchs who are the head of state here in New Zealand, of course, are going to be sort of 80 plus like Prince Charles before they get to the throne. We won't see a Victorian or Elizabethan era or anything like that in the future.
Yes, that's right. Things change. And we have this kind of magical interplay between three effects that go on in terms of how societies change. And one is generational cohort type effects, where generations are different from each other and stay different over time, and they're important, but they're only one third of the explanation. The other parts are life cycle effects, where we do change as we age. It's not that we get utterly set in our ways when we get to a certain age. We do continue to develop as we go through particular life stages. And the third type of effect are period effects, where the context changes for everyone and we're all affected to some degree. And it's really important to have those in mind, because as you're saying there, period effects are shifting all the time about how fast society is changing, how long people are living, technology that we've got available to us, economic effects, all of those different things create that different context, which means it won't be the same. You won't have these same repeated patterns. We do have the 100-year life that people are aiming towards, and that does change people's views of their life cycle. We have delayed adulthood in young people today, where they're going through life stages later than they did, other previous generations did in the past, where you're leaving home later, getting married later, having kids later, all of those types of things, shift things around the life cycle for society overall. So, yeah, it's an interplay between these things. It's quite rich and nuanced when you unpick it like that, instead of just trying to sum up a whole generation as materialistic or some other adjective you come up with.
For example, the cliche about the millennials, that often a stick used to beat them with, you picked out someone's tweet in your book about, oh no, I have hurt my finger slicing my avocado, how am I going to fix my top knot? You know, sort of. But on the other hand, like, just to say what you say, the period effects, the lifestyle effects, the cohort effects, the way these things overlap between these generations that people pick out, I mean, they actually share more experiences. And as you pointed out in another part of the book, housing is such a huge issue now, the affordability of housing for younger people, and a bit of despair about that. But you say, look, older generations often, you know, recount their own miserable housing stories. A quote here, renting has always been shit. Why do you lot think you're so special, from the older generation to the younger ones?
Yeah, that's true. And I think we often get misdirected to these stories that you see about, you know, bemoaning the kind of condition of housing for young people, or how they have to have, very small or grubby spaces that they go into, which is really, it's a distraction from the really big picture on housing, which there is one, for a truly generational story about the unaffordability of housing, buying your own home in lots of countries around the world. We've had stagnating wages, increased student debt and other types of debt for young people, which does make it much more difficult to own in lots of countries. And that shifts people's lives, because private renting is less secure, more expensive. So you settle down into your family rearing years later. That's sort of intertwined with those decisions on delaying children and other aspects of life. So there's really important big economic shifts that have altered the life course for younger generations that get lost in these stereotypes about the Four Yorkshiremen skit that Monty Python did about who had the worst housing when they were being brought up. That's the sort of level of commentary that we often get, when actually these are big economic trends. They're the things that we should be looking at.
Yeah, and in fact, you point to that, saying, look, the backlash on the baby boomers, you know, the pulling the ladder up behind them, consolidating their gains and so on, that is something of a lazy transgenerational stereotype. However, you've pointed out, it's the concentration of wealth within cohorts, right, that then leads to the generational transfer of inequality. And this is more than just, you know, pure cash and resources, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, yes, the first point of that is really important, that not all baby boomers made it big by any means. And yes, it's true, private wealth grew enormously over the past few decades, largely driven by housing booms. Yes, it's true that most of that got concentrated at the top of the age spectrum among particular cohorts. But it is also very varied within that cohort, with the top end of that, the richest end of that cohort, taking nearly all of that increase in wealth, and the bottom ends of that cohort taking none. So very big variations within baby boomers in particular of who's got wealthy. And as you say, that second point then means that when inevitably that comes down towards younger generations in inheritance, it's going to come down very unevenly across different groups. And it does. It is going to increase that sense of inequality between within the next generations, and not just on wealth, but in all sorts of life chances. We are kind of sorting into different social castes, depending on our wealth, but also our social connections and types of work we do, etc. Much more separation on those types of things. So we are getting this almost incipient caste society, where your life chances are set a lot by your family resources, and the story of the next decade or two could well be that solidifying as this wealth, this huge bulge in wealth, starts to trickle down.
This is the part of the book that really made me stop and think, because there are these strange uneven effects that you pointed to. So, for example, you have some stats in the book talking about the UK situation post the 2008 global financial crisis, and so the spending of, whereas, you know, millennials are often
characterized as free spending, spendthrift, materialistic even. In fact, a lot of them spending less now and declining in terms of income than pensioners, just because of the way things have shaken down for some. And yet, fascinatingly, a few pages later, studies grouped together and analysed from a range of countries, there are no countries where there is strong agreement among any age groups that older people get more than their fair share.
Yes, it's true that you get a lot of victim blaming of younger generations of it's all about having fancy coffees or too many avocados or whatever else, fancy brunchies, when it's not to do with that. It's to do with these big economic effects. But then young people themselves do not want to take resources from older people. When you ask people about priorities for public spending more on pensions often comes near the top as one of the top priorities, even among young people. And it's partly to do with age being a really weird characteristic to try to divide people on, because for a number of reasons. First of all, we love our parents and grandparents, and the idea that we would be wanting to take things off them is not very popular with us. We don't want to do that. I mean, secondly, though, there's something a bit more selfish there, as we know that if you take more from them, then the burden may fall more on us. So we want them to be looked after so we don't have to in either time or money. But it's also the case that age is strange because it's one of the few, if not only, characteristics where we will inevitably pass through those stages ourselves. And if we don't die, if we live long enough, we will be old ourselves. So we don't have much clue to how we're going to be treated when we're old, apart from how we treat older people today. So taking resources from older people is a bit of an indicator of how we'll be treated ourselves, and doesn't really, again, sit with us. And then finally, we do tend to have a very strong sense of contribution being important, that people who've paid in or done things with their lives should be supported and should reap the benefits of that. So it's very hard to get people fired up across generations on these types of things.
Indeed, and we have the transcript of that Four Yorkshiremen sketch from Monty Python, which I guess will make baby boomers cringe because that's what, almost 50 years old, I guess, that sketch. But
yes.
I think the succeeding generations will laugh at the opening of the chapter, Stagnation Generation, where you have a quote of the headline in Money magazine from March 1983, "The baby boomers, can they ever live as well as their parents?"
Yes.
An anxious question, exactly. Which I guess not many people are asking these days.
No. But it does show you, well, it shows you another thing as well about our view of history, which is now that that's the way it's turned out, it feels like that was always the way it was going to turn out. We have this, it's called hindsight bias, where we think because something has happened, it's bound to have happened. When actually, there was a lot of times for baby boomers when things didn't look quite so rosy financially, in terms of they had definitely had their own housing price crashes and difficult economic times. But actually, in the end, it did turn out pretty well for a large bulk of baby boomers. But it wasn't always inevitably looking like that for them.
Well, I'm talking to Bobby Duffy. He's the director of the Policy Institute at King's College London and the author of the fascinating book Generations, How and Why We Change. Well, Bobby, earlier we mentioned Douglas Copeland saying there's a ton of money to be made by demonising the young, and that partly explained why we have these antagonistic and exclusive labels of generations one after the other. But is he right? Is there a business to be done with this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes beyond demonising, though. It's not just setting young people up as, you know, bad examples of whatever the issue is. It is about exaggerating or even just creating differences between generations in order to sell you the solution to that. That's the kind of classic consultancy business model. I'll tell you I have a problem, and then I'll tell you I have the solution. And, you know, you see that a lot in workplace-based research and consultancy, where that's one of the noisiest engines of generational myths and stereotypes, is it's always the latest generation are utterly different in what they want from work or how they behave at work. So, you know, Gen Z, current youngest generation, you see endless articles and commentary about how they are they're looking for something completely different from what millennials were looking for. And the reality is all the best evidence, all the academic evidence shows that there's no real cohort on cohort, generation on generation change in how people view work or behave at work. There are changes that happen over your life cycle, definitely, that young people are looking for something different from older people or behave differently from older people. But that's always the case. And again, we just forget how different we were or our cohort was when we were coming through. So yes, there's a kind of consultancy business around claiming that there's differences, and it's, you know, it's worth like $70 million in the US just on that very pure consultancy business. And there's 400 people apparently on LinkedIn who class themselves as millennial experts or millennial consultants. So you've got that kind of bit, but it's much broader than that. If you're doing press releases around particular products or targeted at consumers, or you're working out a brand strategy or advertising strategy for a particular product or service, then these generational labels are used a lot to get newspaper coverage, because it's such a nice shorthand, simple shorthand. Quite often it's things like millennials are killing something, whether that's, you know, millennials killing the napkin industry or killing the Olympics or wine corks or diamond rings. We could talk for the next hour about things millennials are supposed to have killed, and it's just good headlines. But it adds up. I think the problem is, while we don't take it that seriously, there's so much of it that it does color our views of different generations. And you can see that in the surveys that I look at. We do have these very cliched views of Gen Z being materialistic and lazy. They're tech savvy. That's the one positive thing that people will pick out about Gen Z. But everything else is a fairly negative view that kind of reflects our denigration of young people, but also these headlines that claim they're lazy and et cetera.
Yeah, and a lot of that's about consumption and habits and so on, isn't it? But there's a whole chapter about work in your book where you actually say what truly generational differences exist in the workplace. Virtually none. 20 international studies focused on job satisfaction, commitment, intended job moves, and concluded the relationship between whatever membership of your generation and the outcomes of those decisions were essentially zero.
Yes, it is. When you say, you know, to counter that, you'll see endless headlines saying the death of loyalty in the workplace from either millennials or Gen Z. This has been going on for some years. So you've got these really stark claims that we've got this big change. When you look at the data, there's just no truth in it. It's true that young people move jobs more often than older people, but that's always been the case. And if anything, younger generations today are holding on to their jobs for longer because jobs are less secure. So you hold on to what you've got. And it's actually older groups that are moving more often than they used to in the past.
Yeah, so some of this you can clearly make a kind of career if you're cunning in telling businesses, you know, your business will fail if you fail to understand the succeeding generation of consumers. But is there a darker side to it too, Bobby, in that, you take it on in the book, the so-called culture wars, you know, which are not now a new phenomenon, but where everything's to been reduced to, I guess, two kind of competing and exclusive ideological worldviews. Maybe, you know, in the States it can be seen like attitudes about abortion or about guns, very hard line, one or the other, and that this is somehow feeding into this generational complex that's been created.
Yeah, absolutely. The sense that there is a generational culture war going on is strengthening across different countries and based on a misreading of the reality. So when I got very long-term data trends where you can go back to the differences between baby boomers and pre-war generation when baby boomers were relatively young, and you can see that the gaps between that baby boomer generation and the pre-war generation on attitudes to things like gender equality or homosexuality or race are just as big as the gaps between young and old generation today. So what we haven't got is a massive step change in gaps on these social and cultural issues between the young and older groups. It's just very natural continuation of a trend that we've been on for 40 or 50 years of more liberal attitudes to lots of these things. But it's painted as we have a cohort of social justice warriors coming through right now, facing off against a kind of okay boomer generation who don't care about those types of things. And neither of those things are true, but it does serve political purposes to get this sense of conflict. When you start to put culture change, concern about culture change, at the heart of your political discussion and choices, you're inevitably building in a separation between the generations. And then you're dividing people politically on age, creates all sorts of weird incentives for political parties. As we've seen a little in the US, where one side thinks they've got demography on their side. If you've got a young cohorts that you appeal to, and you just have to, you get drawn to the edge of culture change, you get drawn to the leading edge of trends on that and become more pulled in that direction. But if you have an older cohort group as your supporters, you're really incentivized to exaggerate the extremism on the other side and to say that they're all social justice warriors and you should come towards us. And you get this quite bad dynamic where people are fighting for their bases. What we really worry about in culture wars is not disagreement. It's where you get two worldviews, as you say, that are utterly opposed, and you just think the other side is wrong or even evil. It's not just that they are you disagree with them, it's you actually think they've got bad intentions, which is really worrying.
Well, Bobby, we've had, I guess, the wartime generation, or greatest generation, as I like to call it, boomers, millennials, Y, Z, now maybe with a COVID generation, so-called. Do you think, I mean, it's already being used in the media analysis, I think, the predicted impact of the pandemic. Do you think that there will be people talking about a Generation C or a Generation COVID, that, and it actually means something?
Of all the events that you can imagine creating a worthwhile and meaningful generational labelling, then I think Generation COVID is a possibility. I think that's worth considering seriously, much more so than what you usually see is people trying to name generations after tiny trends like a particular games console or a particular social media platform, a TikTok generation or a Nintendo generation, those types of things. But this is obviously very different. This is a huge global event that has had different effects on different groups depending on their age. So that's a sort of classic of that could well have a cohort effect. So I think it is worth thinking about that seriously. Of course, people are already, before COVID, were talking about Generation Alpha as the one that would follow from Z or Z. But I think we should be reassessing whether there's something distinctive about young people who had all the educational disruptions and all the social disruptions and then employment disruptions of COVID, and whether that stays with them or whether we can hopefully get over that and recover fully from it.
Well, finally, Bobby, you do have a question in the book, which was prompted by President Obama, I think, raising the question, would you choose to, still to be born now? And him, without hesitating, saying, of course you would. Life's great. What about you? Would you? Would you want to be born now into Generation C or whatever succeeds it?
Yeah, I think, as I conclude in the book, I think just about yes. The question, the full question is, if you didn't know where you were going to be born, into what social class or income you were going to be born, whether you, what gender or race or anything you would be, the answer would be now, definitely, because we are moving forward. The downside is actually some of those groups are going backwards in you know, very real terms, in terms of their life expectancy is actually dropping for less well-off women in the north of England and for less educated white groups in the US. There are these kind of counter trends. But even after all that, I'm still optimistic about the future and how we actually have agency to make things better. That's one of the great joys of looking at things generationally over the long term. It's so often in the past, people have thought things, everything is lost and all messed up. And then you just can watch it over time as it starts to improve. We do have agency ourselves, and that should give us some optimism.
Well, that's great. You've certainly given me a bit of optimism and a lot to think about. Thanks so much, Bobby Duffy, Director of the Policy Institute at King's College London and author of the fascinating book Generations, How and Why We Change. Though, Bobby, I do note that you're also the author of a book called The Perils of Perception, Why We're Wrong About Nearly Everything. So do I have to take some of what you say with a bit of a pinch of salt?
Yes, definitely. It's you should always watch your subtitles to these books because they do end up contradicting each other.